Thank you, Floyd. On the way up here, I was reminded, I was telling Floyd I talked more about my brother than I had in years. And it didn't occur to me why that was. And I think it's because Floyd reminds me of my brother. He's got the same dry sense of humor and that good old boy personality that puts everybody at ease. Kind of like alcohol. Hadn't done this in a while, so I'm nervous as most of us are, I guess. But I think I can manage to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Every time I do this, I'm reminded of something I heard on Car Talk one time. As a guy was talking about a sign on his vet's wall. It said, veterinary medicine and taxidermy. No matter what happens, you get your dog back. And I want you folks to be sure that AA is going to be here no matter how bad this is. The thing I found in AA when I first got here was one of my favorite authors' expression that he read to know he was not alone. Well, I come to AA meetings to know I'm not alone. I spend most of my life in my own head, and I found out that that's where my disease is. Alcohol and drugs are a symptom of my disease. My disease is between my ears. And I can come to you people, and if I'm brave enough to make myself vulnerable and tell you what's on my mind and what's worrying me, invariably I get an answer that I would not have had otherwise. And it's kept me more sane than I have been in many years. You see, I have this peculiar mental twist. Alcoholics are said to have it. I don't think we really get rid of it. We used to have a guy named James O. Unfortunately, he's dead now. But on Sunday morning, he'd sit in the same seat at the end of the table, and he would say, I'm 100% dry, and I'm 90% sober. And it took me about 3 years to figure out what he was talking about. I'm 100% dry, and I've never made 90% sober. But I'm usually the other side of 50%, and for me, that's a great change. I've heard people say that they were born an alcoholic, and I think for me that was true. I'm always amazed at how it works and how it exemplifies my disease. I don't know how you people got in this program, but they created this thing for me back in 1935 because it expresses exactly the way I feel about things. See, I'm constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. I can remember thinking, it'll be different this time. Never was. Well, I'm only hurting myself. Well, I was hurting everybody around me. And the big lie, the one I believed with all my heart, was my life is just not worth living. All I had to do to correct that was be around you people and stop pouring an organic solvent on my brain and let it heal. My disease started, I think, in my first memory. When I was about 2, I had this terrible vision that something terrible happened. And I never could grasp exactly what it was. All I knew were that I was a little child and I was walking around between big black cars with white wall tires. And it was nighttime and they all had their lights on. And everybody was excited. And it frightened me and I cried for hours to the point I was exhausted. And I would ask my mother what that was about, and she would say, it's a nightmare. Don't worry about it. I also noted that I didn't have a father. Everybody else had a father, and I didn't have one. And I asked my mother, what happened to my father? And she said, he died. I said, well, how did he die? She said, he died in a hospital. I'd say, how did he die in the hospital? He died of pneumonia in the hospital. And that's all she would say. So I spent my entire childhood thinking that my father died of pneumonia in the hospital, a natural death. I had a brother. Alcohol killed him when he was 35. But when I was about 10 or 11, he was 7 years older than I was telling him about Daddy dying in the hospital, and he said, is that what you think? I said, yes. He said, well, let me tell you what happened to your daddy. My father was a county agent in Walker County in 1945, and everybody else had gone to war. He had a deferment and was at home, and he and a guy who was the probate judge in Walker County pretty much ran the county. All the men were gone. They had all the whiskey, all the sugar, all the tires, all the nylons, and all the women. And my mother stood it as long as she could. She called her brother, my Uncle Jim, to come and get her from Birmingham. He came out, loaded mother and my brother Don and I in the car, and headed back to Birmingham. Dad came home and asked the neighbors where we were, and they told him. He got in his car. Of course, he was drinking. He ran us down at the Warrior River Bridge, which is about 12 miles outside of Jasper, and he ran Uncle Jim off the road. And he got out of the car waving a pistol around, saying mother could go, but he wanted his boys. Well, Uncle Jim had a pistol, and he got afraid of my father, and he shot him. So at the age of 2, I'd seen my uncle kill my father. I don't remember the exact incident. All I remember was that it was something awful that happened. Not only that, but my childhood was marred by alcoholism in other ways. My mother loved alcoholics. She dated them, married 2. She had this penchant for marrying abusive men. I asked her in later years, why did she keep doing that? Why did she marry somebody that was an earth person, as Linda said this morning? And she gave me the same answer that Linda gave. He said, earth people are dull. I couldn't figure out what was exciting about getting beaten up every other week, but that was the way it was. She married a guy named Mac McGlone. Hope none of you are related to him. And Mac had a tendency to beat mother up when he was drinking and she was drinking. He stabbed her once. He always threatened her with a butcher knife. I never really knew what a butcher knife was, but I knew it was a big one, and you did bad things with it. He cut her in the arm once, and I remember standing in the hall begging him not to kill her another time, and he threatened to kill me. And that was when I was about 4 or 5. I can remember when I hated to see the sun go down, because strange things happened at my house when the sun went down. Everything else was all right during the daytime. But once night fell, strange things happened. We had dinner at the table every night. But sometimes my mother would look at me with this silly grin, and I can remember specifically that she would occasionally fall out of her chair. And I didn't understand what all that was about. But we lived in this schizophrenic kind of atmosphere where things were clean in the daytime and orderly, and when night fell, everything went crazy. Things got broken, people got hit or stabbed, or windows got broken. Bad stuff happened. You know, there was an 800-pound gorilla at my house, and nobody saw it but me. And I couldn't figure out how all that went away when the sun came up. I can remember sitting on the front porch, hugging a black dog, thinking that was the only thing in the world that loved me. And then my dog died, and I was totally alone. And I learned to stay in my head. My brother was 7 years older than I was, and he couldn't stand Mac, and he went to live with my aunt, leaving me there. The only good thing about it was Mac was a traveling salesman, and he would stay gone 2 and 3 weeks at a time, and that was the bliss of my life, being alone with my mother. But finally, Mother had enough of that, and she kicked him out of the house. He came back once, threatening to kill everybody, and we had the police come and get him. And finally, he went away and stayed away. Mother still loved alcoholics. She loved to dance. She loved a good time, and she loved to drink. But Mother didn't hold it very well. Finally, things got better. Mother got a job. She began to date a guy that was not an alcoholic. And things improved around my house. Come to find out, Mother had joined AA. But she never told me that. The reason I know my mother was in AA is when she died, her things were stored in a storage locker. And after her funeral, I went and was cleaning out the locker, and I found the Serenity Prayer cross-stitched in a frame in that locker. The frame was broken and it was dirty, and I took it out of that and had it reframed and cleaned, and now it's hanging in my kitchen. And I understood now what brought about some of the good things in my life as a child. I developed this sense of trying to be perfect because of all the chaos. There's a family dynamic about children who, my brother was the scapegoat child. He did everything he could to disrupt things, and I was the hero child. I was going to be perfect. Of course, I couldn't be perfect, so I had this sense of shame and guilt. My mother also wanted me to be perfect. I remember one night she said, "Well, why aren't you doing homework?" I said, "Well, I don't have any homework to do." She said, "Well, you need to be doing some kind of schoolwork." I said, "Mother, my report card last year had 38 A's on it. What do you want from me?" And she said, "The school's too easy. We're going to find a harder one." So I got this sense of being not good enough. No matter what I did was not good enough. And it's followed me all my life. Not what I did, it's what I didn't do. I always felt like I was going to be graded and come up short. My brother had gone to live with my aunt. He began to drink, and he was a brilliant man. He was a lot smarter than I was. He was a lot tougher than I was. He could do anything in the world with his hands. He was a leader of men. People loved to be around him. I always wanted to be like my brother, but I couldn't. I remember in later years he would say, "This is my little brother Billy. He went to school till he ran out of school to go to. You know what that means?" And they would say, "No." And he would say, "That means he's an educated idiot." And that was pretty much the way I was. You know, I could get information out of a book, but you give me a practical situation, I was lost. Now, some of that's gotten better over the years, but it's still true. If it doesn't bleed, I can't fix it. I'm a general surgeon by trade. We didn't have any money. Most money my mother ever made in her life was about $4,000 a year. Of course, in the late 50s, that was enough. We didn't hurt for anything. But I had a sense of shame that I didn't have the right size coat. Mother would always buy me a coat so that I could grow into it. Well, the coat would wear out before I ever grew into it. And I always walked around looking like Goofy. But I had the sense of being less than. And it followed me all of my life, and it's still there. I finished high school. I played football in high school, and I was a pretty good athlete. I tried to do things my brother wouldn't do. Football coach asked my brother why he didn't play football, and he said, well, it interfered with his screwing around. Of course, that was a polite way that he put it. But Don would do things like make homebrew in the wash house. He had a job unloading trucks at the A&P, and there'd be sugar in the trucks, and they would conveniently drop the 50-pound bags of sugar, and they got to keep all the sugar. And they would bring it home and make homebrew out of it. All I can remember when I was a child was that the wash house was full of bees all the time. I couldn't figure out what all that bee stuff was out there. And I would look in these churns they had over there with cheesecloth over them. There'd be bugs in it. And they would strain the bugs off and then drink it. I thought that was horrible. Little did I know that 20, 30 years later, I'd be drinking Listerine. Don decided he was going to be a farmer. My father had a farm down around Lafayette, Alabama, and he went down there and he did well for a time until the farm economy went sour and he got in debt. Got to drinking more and more to make himself feel normal. I knew he was drinking a lot, but I had no idea he was drinking as much as he was drinking. When he was 35, I got a phone call in the middle of the night. 2 o'clock in the morning, Don's dead. How in the world did that happen? Well, he was trying to stopped drinking. He made it till about 10 o'clock and then drank a beer and went to bed. Woke up, had a seizure, vomited, aspirated, and was dead. So my father was 35 when my uncle shot him. My brother was 35 when he died. Needless to say, 35 was a bad year for me. But at any rate, when I graduated from high school, I got a scholarship to Auburn University to play football. There were 55 boys on the Auburn freshman football team. They didn't have limits on how many you could sign. So they'd sign as many as they could and run the ones off that they called eaters. Well, I was a starting halfback on the fifth team. 11 goes into 55 five times. So the peculiar mental twist came out. I got depressed. I remember getting up in the morning and sitting on the front porch of my hooch and weeping till time to go to practice. I decided, well, I can't quit. I'm not a quitter. But what I can do, see, I have a plan. I'm not a poor planner. Unfortunately, my plans don't work very well, but I got them. 2 o'clock in the morning, I make plans that won't work about stuff that won't happen. And it's exhausting. But I can remember my plan. My plan was that I'm going to hit those people so hard that I'm going to hurt myself bad enough they'll have to send me home. And I can go home with honor. Unfortunately, I got to making so much noise hitting people that they began to move me up through the teams. And not only did I not get to go home, I got to start the three freshman football games that we played. Auburn was going through a transition and everybody played both ways. They needed somebody to play defense for the quarterback. All the quarterbacks were getting hurt, and they decided, well, we'll get some cannon fodder and put them in on defense for the quarterback and let them play defense. So they called us wild cards. We could change two football players at the turn of the ball. And Bill Cody and I were the guys who went in. He went in for the fullback, and I went in for the quarterback. So I got to play. I lettered 3 years. In 1963, we were the fifth football team in the country. We went 9-2 that year. We had the best defensive football team in the country. And we played Nebraska in the Orange Bowl. They beat us 13-7. Next year, Jimmy Seidel's picture was on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and we were picked to be number one in the country by Sports Illustrated. We lost four football games. Needless to say, I was happy to be free of football. I had gotten into a pre-med curriculum and had done pretty well at it. Applied to medical school at UAB and was accepted. Somebody told me after I'd gotten in that, you know, you really need to apply to five or six. I said, well, if I can't get in Alabama, I can't get in anywhere. And if I can't get in Alabama, I sure can't afford to go anywhere else. But I love medical school. Now, this entire time, I was not drinking to amount to anything, except when I was a senior at Auburn, I began to drink some beer, and I noticed that it made me feel great. The fear that consumed me went away. I became brave, a little too brave sometimes. I jumped on an airborne ranger in Columbus, Georgia one night, and he almost killed me because he was better fighting drunk than I was. But I ran out of bad that night. At any rate, went to medical school and loved it. Did well in medical school. I graduated in the top 10% of my class. Graduated eighth out of a class of 80. Made the Honor Society AOA. When I got through with medical school, I'd had a sweetheart, and I decided that, you know, the thing to do to fill that hole that I'd felt that so many of us do, I still felt incomplete and less than. See, no matter what I did, I felt like an imposter. I'd get all kinds of pieces of paper to hang on the wall, but I kept feeling like somebody was going to tap me on the shoulder and say, well, you know, you've been lucky so far, but now it's up. You're done. At any rate, I got married, went into the Baptist Hospital residency program, spent 5 years there. I was the first resident they had, so I got to be chief resident for 5 years. Got a tremendous amount of experience. Fell in love with a guy named B.H. Johnson, trained at the Mayo Clinic. And I thought I could help Dr. Johnson because he was by himself. And I went to Bessemer and moved my family out there. We had four daughters in 4 years. Had one set of twins. I wasn't that good. But I kept thinking all that was going to, I was going to be normal. But I wasn't. My wife found a man who had half a lot. And he, when I was a resident, and it was always kind of what I was doing was so much more important than what she was doing. I was working in the emergency room every other night, and I was working covering the house every other night. And see, I'm a workaholic, too. I have to justify my existence. I can't just do what's expected of me. I've got to do something beyond that. because I want people to think well of me. At any rate, I was working like a fool, and she found this man that had this lot and had a house plan. He was a retired builder, and she was the cutest little thing you ever saw, and she just charmed his pants off. So they got easements from the people on both sides of this half a lot, and they built this house in 3 months. And she got ready to move into her house. And I had to ask her how to get there. I had seen it one time in 3 months, and that was in the middle of the night. Needless to say, she felt neglected. And she let me know that, but we stuck it out for a while because of the children. The children grew up, went off to school. And the minute all the children were in college, she left me. She found an airline steward, 10 years her junior, fell in love with him, and left. And I was amazed. How in the heck could she leave me? What a prince of a guy I was. Making a six-figure income. Didn't care what she spent it on. She was gone. Not only did she leave, the thing that hurt me the most, a year later she married him. She didn't want my alimony. I said, holy mackerel. I must have really made her mad. But I was pleased with the fact that I thought the children lived with me. Well, that's where the cars were. That's where the swimming pool was. That's where the TVs were. That's where the allowance was. One, because they loved old daddy. But after all that happened, I began to drink more. Then I found something to take the anxiety off. Benzodiazepines, Valium, Ativan, Dalmane. Drink whiskey, and when I got nervous, I'd take a sedative. The combination of alcohol and benzodiazepines is the most neurotoxic combination you can ingest, save airplane glue. Little did I know how much trouble I was getting in. I increased my intake to about a quart of vodka a day and was taking stuff to help me sleep and take the nerves, the nervous anxiety and withdrawal symptoms away. And my liver got sick. I was doing fine, I thought, except I was depressed, and I knew that. So I tried to turn my life and my will over to the care of Prozac, as I understood it. Let me tell you, Prozac doesn't work if you're drinking a quart of vodka a day. That's the title of my book, Don't Do This Stuff, It Will Not Work. My brain got sicker and sicker, but the last thing to go, I found out, in terms of neurological function, is communication skills. Now, I could talk my way out of a hat. I just couldn't calculate. I got up one morning on my day off and had been drinking most of the night before and went to the hospital, made it through one hospital, and got to the second one and passed out in a doctor's lounge. They shook me awake and said, let us take you home. And that thing I'd feared all those years had come to pass. The jig was up. There was a place in Atlanta called Talbert Recovery Systems that was designed for healthcare professionals. And I said, well, that's where I'll go for 28 days and I'll be fine. Because I'd heard that recovery system lasted about 28 days. Well, I got over there, and there were about 120 doctors from all over the country. What I didn't realize was it was a tertiary care center for people that had relapsed and had neurotoxicity the way I did. And we had this big room, and we'd check in every morning, about what's going on, one little sentence about what's going on with you. And they would go around the room and they would say, my name's so-and-so, I'm from Atlanta, Georgia, and I've been here 3 months. 3 months? And there were people who have been there 5 months, 6 months, 7 months. I said, heck fire, what am I doing here? Then they gave me an IQ test. Scared me to death. I found out I'd knocked about 40 points off my IQ. My memory was at the 18th percentile. I'd always prided myself on my memory. I could read something one time and it'd be mine. No more. Checking in, I would come up with two sentences I was going to tell the group when it got around to me, and when it got around to me, I would have forgotten one of my sentences. And I was despondent. You know, I thought my life was over. I've lost my ability to practice medicine. I'd lost my ability to think. Abstract thinking was gone. Problem-solving ability was gone. Memory was shot. I said, well, that's it. I'm done. No telling what I would have done if I was at home. Because before I went to treatment, I had decided the big lie, that my life was not worth living. So I cleaned this .38 pistol every night, thinking it'd be, maybe I can do it tonight. I can remember about 3 days before I went to treatment, I had the pistol in my lap, and I was making a plan. And my plan was, I'm either going to kill myself or go get a hamburger. Those two things had equal importance in my mind. People say, why don't you lose weight? I said, yeah, being fat saved my life. You know, being an overeater is part of my disease, thank God. But I was in treatment, and there were some fine people there, the very smart folks. And they said, well, we want you to take this medicine because we think you're depressed. Well, I started taking the medicine and I got a little better. I took it for about 2 months and they gave me another test. I was a little better, but not much better. And they decided that, well, we want you to take lithium. Well, my mother had taken lithium. My mother turned out to be a bipolar individual, and that's one of those inherited things, and they told me I was unipolar. I wasn't bipolar. There wasn't anything high about me. Somebody gave me a refrigerator magnet one time. I still tend to be kind of morose. Gave me a refrigerator magnet. We're black Irish, my mother says. It says the Irish have an abiding sense of tragedy that sustained them through brief periods of joy. And that's the way I am. You know, I look at the dark side of everything. The big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says avoid morbid reflection. Hell, that's the only kind of reflection I had. And I told them, I said, you know, I'd been there about 5 months and I wasn't getting that much better anymore. And they said, we want you to take lithium because we think it'll help the antidepressant work better. And I said, I don't want to take lithium. Crazy people take lithium, because my mother had been absolutely crazy. She'd been hypomanic and I'd seen it. She beat me with her purse one night when I went up to Athens to get her. She just, all the way from Athens to Birmingham, she beat me with her purse, screaming in my ear that the best edge had died, talking about my brother. I didn't want to take it. The psychiatrist says, hell, son, you've been in a mental hospital for 5 months. Why do you think you're here? I said, well, that's kind of hard to argue with. So I started taking the medicine. And from the first dose, I felt better. I wanted to talk. Now, there wasn't any content to what I had to say, but I began to talk, and I talked about all my childhood stuff, everything I was afraid of. I began to rattle stuff off. They couldn't shut me up. At one time, they thought I was becoming manic, but I wasn't. I was just spewing all that stuff I'd choked down for years and years. And I began to get better, and they gave me another IQ test, and I was doing better. I stayed another 2 months, and they gave me another test, and I made a better score on it. They said, "Well, we think you're well enough to go home." I said, "Oh, give me another test." I'm doing so much better, I just wanted to be perfect. They said, "No, we're going to send you home." Now, the shame, I've heard that this is a fear-based and shame-based disease, and for me, that was exactly the way it was. I didn't want to go home. I didn't want to face the people that knew. I hated for the mail to come because invariably somebody had sent me a card that had found out where I was. And I was distraught. I would try to not open the mail. The counselors would make me open the mail. But I was sent back home. They let me go to the office an hour a day. I walked into the Bessemer group because that was the closest group there. Door didn't have a window in it. If the door had a window, I never would have gone through it. Because the first thing I wanted to do was peep in the window and see if there was anybody in there that knew me. Turned out there were several people in there that knew me. And were glad to see me. I had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and that room became a tremendous part of my recovery. I think I got talking about God and love, and about that time cynicism's always been a part of my disease, and I said, you know, I don't believe in love, and I don't believe in God, and, you know, what am I going to do? They said, if you don't develop a sense of spirituality, you're not going to make it. And somebody pointed out to me that the word spirituality is, the root word is spiritus, means to breathe. This is a way to breathe. Kept going to AA meetings and went to a speaker meeting one night, and a guy told his story, and it was one of the most powerful things I'd ever heard. If lack of power was my dilemma, what he said was powerful. And I was sitting there, and this lightning bolt, little chunk of truth came to my head. You know, there's power in the truth. I don't have to say I believe in God. All I have to say is there's power in the truth. And if there's power in the truth, there's power in principle. And there's a principle behind each one of those steps, and that's my religion. That's my higher power. And that's what sustained me for the first couple of years. Now, since then, I got to the point where I pray to God I don't understand, because I'm not that smart. But I do it, and it helps me stay sane, and I believe that God answers some of my prayers. Many times he says no. But an 18-year-old boy told me one time, we were talking about God, and I says, "Do you pray?" And he said, "Yes, I do." I said, "Well, do you always get what you ask for?" And he says, "No." I said, "Well, why do you keep it up?" He says, "Because I believe that if I pray, it turns out the way God wants it to." And that was a profound concept to me. You know, God shuts doors and opens windows. You better stop doing this and start doing that. I got one of those sponsors that says, you know, Edge, what you ought to do is stop doing this and start doing this. And the day I started doing this, I began to get better and better. My life turned around. My practice increased. I have this sense now of meaningful work to do. When I went to treatment, there was absolutely no meaning to my existence. Absolutely none. But there is meaning to my life today. I have a vocation that turned out to be an avocation. And I can help people in lots of ways. And for me, that gives me a sense of self-worth, and it gives me a sense of reward, and it keeps me sane, along with the fact that I go to AA on Saturday and Sunday. I love going to that room. When I was in treatment, I would read the Bible, read the book of Job. I wouldn't advise that for recovering people. Book of Job says, "That which I feared has come upon me, and that which I was afraid has come unto me. I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came." And trouble comes. I can do the best I can, and trouble comes. But with the help of you people and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't obsess about it the way I used to. It does not destroy me. I still take medication. I no longer have to take lithium, but I have to take antidepressants, because with me it is a genetic thing. And the one thing I know it does for me is it stops the morbid reflection. I no longer lay awake every night trying to make plans for every negative contingency of my life. I can go back to sleep. And to me, that's one of the biggest gifts of recovery. Thank God you people are here tonight. Thank God the people in Bessemer come to AA on Saturday morning and Sunday morning. I used to have nightmares about going up there and the door would be locked and they'd moved and didn't tell me where they went. I still think they're going to do it one day. They're saving money now, I know. They're taking their bingo money and going to build somewhere, and I'm not going to know where they are. But it's been a gift to me. Recovery means exactly what it means. The promises have come true. I wouldn't take anything in the world for that little room in Bessemer, Alabama. Further on down in the book of the Bible, it says, "Surely God was in this place and we knew him not." And that's the way I was for the first few months I was there. But I've come to know a God of my understanding. And there's a comfort in that. And moreover, he speaks to me through Floyd. That's scary. But we help each other that way. See, I can see Floyd's disease, and he can see mine. My problem is I can't see mine. Surely God could and would if he were sought. And for me, that's what it takes. If there's a higher power, there's a lower power. My disease talks to me every day. I was telling somebody the other day, a fellow I don't like came down the hall and said, "I'm glad you're back." What I heard him say was, "You're a piece of crap and I'm not." So, you know, I have to ask somebody to interpret what people are saying to me, because I'm a mind reader. I have a disease of perception. I think things are one way and they're not that way. But you people keep me straight. You laugh at me when I need to be laughed at. You dog cuss me when I need to be dog cussed. And you keep me straight. I am tickled to death that Floyd asked me to come here. I have dreaded this for 2 years. I have given this talk about 300 times. But thank God I'm here. Thank God you people are here. Thank God there's a way out of the disease we all share. Thank God we don't have to suffer like we used to. The thing that got us here was trouble and suffering. But we don't have to do that anymore. Unless we get away from the program, which I'm prone to do. I did it several times over the years, and every time I come back, and I come back with a renewed belief that the answer is here. It's not out there. It's the best therapy in town for a dollar. Thank God there are meetings. I've enjoyed this retreat. I've learned a great deal. I enjoy you talking about your disease and your experience and sharing it with me. And I'm more than happy to share mine with you. Thank you very much.